Welcome to Winning Slowly, taking the long view on technology, religion, ethics, and art. I'm Stephen Carradini.
And I'm Chris Kreicho, and today we're going to talk mostly about religion and ethics. Fair heads up to our secular listeners out there, we will get to some broader application, but we're going to open up today talking about some things that have happened in a fairly high-profile church, and talking about things that happen in churches to start. So, hang with us. We'll try and make it interesting for you along the way. This week, after a couple months of everyone wondering what was going to happen.
You could also count it as years, but we'll just give them the benefit of the doubt for months.
Yeah, yeah. A church named Mars Hill Church up in Seattle, fairly high profile because of its former pastor, Mark Driscoll, who's been in the news off and on over the past several years, sent out a notice saying, we're done. And basically they said they were laying off their immediate staff and all the churches that existed under this umbrella of Mars Hill were now going to be independent churches rather than sites of this one large mega church, which has had 13 campuses up to this point, and those churches will now all be independent and so on. This came as a surprise to some observers, myself included, in the immediate sense, because while I had kind of been hoping for this thing to happen with that church for a long time, I didn't expect them actually to get there so soon. How did they get there? Well, the short version is Mark Driscoll, the pastor who planted Mars Hill Church many years ago, has come under increasing criticism in the last several years. Much of it deserved, some of it not.
Much of it deserved, though. We've even talked about some of his deserved criticism here on Winning Slowly in the episodes of Season Zero.
Yeah. And he resigned 2 months ago. And no one was quite sure exactly what the future of the church was going to be, because the way this has worked has been Mark Driscoll most weeks getting video cast to all of these 13 campuses, and as well,
well
as
12
to,
I mean one he's
right
actually
one
in.
He's actually been at yeah. And so when he left, when he handed in his resignation in the face of this criticism that had mounted and gotten really pretty significant in the last year,
but was still, his resignation was still not asked for by the church itself.
Right. He just went ahead and resigned. And so everyone was kind of wondering, well, what's going to happen with the church? Because they have other people they could pipe into these 13 campuses, but none of them have kind of the star power or appeal of Mark Driscoll, and certainly none of them have the charisma that let Mark Driscoll build a mega church with 13 campuses. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, well, they're going to close their doors, and all of those other churches are going to keep being churches, but they're actually going to start being their own standalone churches, which the theologian in me says, yup, that's kind of what you should have done from the get-go.
Yeah. So from my angle, I've been following this because Mark Driscoll actually shows up as a character in one of my favorite books, Blue Like Jazz, where he is
the cussing pastor.
Mark the cussing pastor. So that was my first introduction to Mark Driscoll. And I have always kind of liked him since then, because that was an important book to me at a particular point in time. And I liked the fact that somebody could be, you know, honest and raw about certain aspects of life and culture and everything. And so that appealed to me. So I've always had kind of an affection for Mark Driscoll, although he has been chipping away at it with various and sundry things. We'll just call them things.
That's probably for the best.
We'll just call them things. And so I've been watching this and seeing that he is a very magnetic personality. He was a very divisive personality. And it seems like there was always a tension there between these campuses that were growing and booming because of his personality and his preaching and all of that. But there were also sub-pastors that were at these churches who were not necessarily getting the name recognition, but they were doing the actual pastoral work of being a pastor.
Right.
And so when all these rumblings came out, I just immediately jumped to, oh, yeah, they're just going to split off all these churches and they're just going to be their own thing. Mark Driscoll's going to go off and do his own thing, be a book guy or whatever. And so I actually told Chris that I hoped that this was going to happen. And I think I only said hoped because even though my expectation was that this was going to happen, like Chris, I also didn't think that it was going to happen quickly. But then when he resigned, I thought that was it. There was no going back. Matt Chandler was not going to take over the Mars Hill Church for sure.
For our secular listeners, Matt Chandler is the pastor of another large multi-campus church who has had many fewer personal and ethical stumbles than Mark Driscoll.
He has had cancer, though.
That is true. Not that cancer is a personal or ethical stumble.
Not that it is.
Lest we be mistaken.
We're not going to talk about faith healing or faith sicknesses on this episode.
No.
But I just, I don't even know why I said that.
But so we could spend all day talking about Mark Driscoll and his ups and downs and foibles and whatnot. But what we thought was more interesting is to look at the church as an entity and what happens when you make this move, whether it's multi-campus or whether it's one ginormous campus. Famously, you have Joel Osteen's church, which seats tens of thousands, and you had the Crystal Cathedral, which did likewise. And I would have other significant reservations and problems with the theology of those particular pastors. But there are commonalities, and even someone whom I really like and who I think is doing a good job in many ways, the aforementioned Matt Chandler, or even a pastor in my own area, J.D. Greer, who's got a very large, successful megachurch.
Mm-hmm.
We think it's important to take a step back and look and say, what are the long-term costs of this?
Right.
What is the cost of saying, we have this technology, let's use it, especially when you have a magnetic personality?
Yes. We have the technology.
There may be downsides.
We can rebuild him.
Yeah. We have the technology. We can rebuild all the things.
But so this is an interesting point that brings us to an even more fundamental aspect of this question is, what should a church do? Should it be a local, small ministry that is deeply tied into the life of the community? Should it be a large gathering of people that are able to, you know, corporately amass a large amount of funds to do a lot of good in the world, community, and abroad? Should it be somewhere in the middle? These are all questions that many churches have to grapple with in a variety of different ways. Do we buy a building? Do we keep renting from the Y? Do we partner with another church? These are all big and weighty questions. And everything that Chris and I say after this is basically going to be our informed ideas and somewhat our informed theology. But this is all things that people grapple with and deal with mm-hmm. all day long. So we are definitely going to be presenting one idea here, the idea that we think is right. But
we're not just presenting an idea.
We're not presenting an idea. We're presenting the one we think is right. But we're also aware that there are a lot of other ideas and reasons for doing things the way that mm-hmm. Chris and I would not do them. So this one is going to be a little more subjective stance, subjective subject position than objective.
And that's especially true given that a lot of these guys, again, are people we respect and that we mm-hmm. think are doing good things. We just think the ways that they're going about it, well, as we often come back to here, the ways they're going about it may ultimately be antithetical to those goals. And I think I would go so far as to say that the megachurch approach, the multi-site approach, even a lot of times an unconsidered multiple services approach, all of these things can ultimately undercut some of the fundamental purposes of the Christian church. We see, going back to the very beginning and going back even to the context of Jewish religion from which Christianity sprang, that this faith is one that is of a community. It is not merely an individual faith. And in America, well, we're a bunch of individualists, and we talk about this a lot because Stephen and I both think that's one of the ways in which American culture can be broken. Individualism is not inherently bad, but individualism as expressed here often tends to an extreme that rejects the value of the community.
Right.
We can reject the value of family. We can reject the value of neighborhoods. We've talked about these things. Well, here we also see a place where we can reject the value of actual real-life community in the context of the church.
Right.
When Paul writes about the church, he uses metaphors like a body or a family, etc. And the same thing is true throughout all of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to be a body or a family when you're one of a sea of faces that show up and exit, and maybe you stand next to the same people every week, but most likely you don't, and yeah, you just go on with your life.
Yeah. And so the flip side of this, of course, is that many people feel like their body has cancer when they're in church.
yeah.
And so it's difficult to say, oh yeah, we're a body, and that person is also collectively some sort of part of my spiritual walk, and that's a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
And that's part of being in a community, is that you have to learn how to deal with and interact with a lot of people that aren't like you and that you don't necessarily like, which is something that Chris and I have talked about before, is that you can have Christian brotherly love for someone and not particularly get along with them all that well in terms of being able to have a conversation. I mean, you don't want to be animosity towards them, but in general, there are some people that they just don't overlap with Chris and I's anything.
And but we love Jesus.
But we love Jesus. And so we're still in community. And that is something that's deeply difficult and is frustrating at times and actually motivates some of these things, is that it's very easy to just show up to something that feels like an event, not have to engage deeply, have some really incredible musical experience, be really encouraged by a set of words, and then call that church.
Right.
And so there's reasons that individuality, which is already, as you noted, deeply tied into the American set of ideals, can be really relaxing and comfortable and comforting in Christianity. But Chris and I both think that communities matter a lot, even when they are hard and messy, and even when they have to do things like censure their own pastor, which is what happened in this particular situation, is that the elders said, look, we need to talk about this because this is becoming a problem. And so Mark Driscoll said, yeah, I think you're right. This is becoming a problem, and I'm going to, you know, to step down now. And so it's those sorts of conflicts and messiness that make community in broad sweeping generalities difficult sometimes. Mm-hmm. But we think that they're valuable.
Yeah, and I would go even beyond valuable. And for the Christian, those kinds of communities where we're seeing unity forged across really, really different kinds of people, they're not just valuable, though of course they are valuable, they're in some sense essential. They are part of what makes our faith our faith. So much of the New Testament is a rejection of tribalism and a rejection of cultural or ethnic superiority, and instead a proclamation that God's salvation is for all people of every ethnic background and every linguistic background and every cultural background. And here I emphasize cultural background, because here's the deal. I am a Colorado guy who aims for a certain degree of intellectualism, and I try to avoid pretentiousness, but let's be honest, I can be a pretentious pedant when it comes right down to it. And I'm sitting here and Stephen knows I can be a pretentious pedant. But I'm sitting here in North Carolina and going to a seminary here. And you know what? There are a lot of guys from the mountains of North Carolina who are as unlike me as you can imagine. And in a lot of ways, you could probably find a random Chinese grad student studying at Duke here who's a Christian and intellectual, and find much more in common with him and me, even though we're from other sides of the planet, than you would find between me and one of the guys who lives here in my neighborhood, who's just a mountain boy, and he's great.
North Carolina.
But we have nothing to talk about.
Yeah. And so, so dealing with these community issues is part of the reason that we have trouble maintaining these ideas of small community, and why we blossom and bloom into these huge ginormous churches, because in the absence of having to deal with these really difficult interpersonal experiences, it's very easy to latch on to somebody who is genuinely very gifted at speaking or at, you know, at relating to people, or, you know, doing these kind of pastorally bound traditions that we have of sermonizing, which are not the only ways that we've sermonized. But it's very easy to latch onto some of those and let that kind of smooth over the the differences in community and working to build that sort of community. And, you know, we're not saying that pastors who can sermonize well are bad, because we need that sort of we need that sort of thing. Chris is going to seminary so he can do that sort of thing, hopefully someday. And so we're not saying that that's bad. We're saying that the response to good sermonizing should not necessarily be, let's get as many people to hear this one sermon as possible. Chris and I are saying it's, let's invest in this community and try to get as many people to hear so that they can be encouraged to go start something like this in their own community.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's challenging there is there are pressures coming from both directions. You have all the pressures we just described of it being easier not to be in community from the perspective of all the people coming to the church.
Right.
But you also have some deep currents in our culture that push toward self-aggrandizement and institutional aggrandizement, where bigger is always better and more is always better. And this particularly can look attractive when you're thinking about evangelism, which from a Christian perspective is commanded. And so there's a sense in which a focus on numbers reflects a very healthy concern that, you know, if we really believe that people's souls are at stake, as we do, then yeah, we ought to be out trying to convert as many of them as possible. And the growth of our church can be, for many of us, can look like a reflection of our faithfulness to doing what God has called us to do. But that can also run into some not so savory things, and it can be very easy to mix up the two and to justify things that are really just about making my own fame increase or making my church's fame increase in the name of all of these other good things. And they can be hard to separate out. I mean, just in my own heart, in my own experience, it's sometimes hard to separate out. Am I writing this blog post to do good to whatever audience I have, or am I writing this blog post so that people think I'm awesome?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's some of both. And I think we see that tension in the leadership of these churches. Generally speaking, I think there's a real desire to reach as many people as effectively, to tell them what we really think is the most important thing in the world.
Right.
But there's also very real human brokenness that means that that can get mixed up with self-aggrandizement.
And as we've talked about before with pastors who write, when people think, wow, this person is really great, we should get them to reach as many people as possible, because it is true, there are pastors who are better at sermonizing than others.
Yeah.
And there are pastors who are better at pastoral care than others. And often these are the two completely different categories. And so, you know, it's easy in our cult of personality, we're moving that way, hold with us, we're almost there. In our cult of personality, it's easy to say, this person is good at this thing, therefore this person should get to the most amount of people in the most ways that we can get them there. This is a general trend, like Chris was saying, of evangelism, but also of everything. Like, we believe that there are people who are objectively better than other people at various things, and that we should listen to those people. Chris and I are not against this. We think Craig Mott is great.
This is good.
Yeah. We're glad you're listening to our podcast, not some random one you picked off of a wheel. So, you know, so we believe in this, but the thing with the Christian life that is kind of antithetical to a lot of Americanism is that the Christian life is generally and sometimes specifically set up with limits. It's set up to be a particular type of thing. The churches that were built in, you know, the early times, they were built around communities. You know, people.
Yeah.
What?
Communities embodying certain practices and making certain affirmations about the world and rejecting certain things as well. Rejecting certain behaviors as out of bounds for both the members of the church and then especially for the leaders of the church.
Right. And even, I mean, and some of those are, you know, the big bads, but some of them are the you know, the less bads, you know, and some of them are, even outside of moral sorts of issues, they get into, you know, practical issues like what is wise in this situation, not necessarily even moral. You know, what is the best way of doing things? How large should we be? How concerned should we be with size? Because there's a, like you said, the underlying tension is if we do well, we will grow.
Right.
Which is not necessarily true. There are plenty of churches I know that are doing well that do not grow, and some even die. Yep. And that is just a reality of the way that church planting works. It's a tough thing. But there are also plenty of churches that grow that aren't doing the right thing. So And the point that I want to make before we jump into cult of personality is that growing doesn't mean that you're doing good or bad, but it does mean that you should be considering splitting and growing and into ways that more reflect the communities that you're drawing from. Because if you're, unless you're in New York City and you're drawing massive numbers of people from a very tiny area, the growth of your church is going to be directly related to the growth of your footprint of that church. And if your footprint becomes ginormous, then it's time to lop off the ends of that footprint and turn them into their own churches and bring in more pastors and do the growth that way. Because the biggest evangelistic success rates come from new churches, not from churches that are growing ginormously. And I know that seems like a weird statistic, but or a weird fact, but that's the way that people who aren't churched grow into churches.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is because the growth in large churches, like the Mars Hill growth, tends to be, not entirely, but tends to be a lot of people coming there from other churches. And so that's a consequence that as leadership you have to consider. You know, as Stephen said, sometimes you think, I mean, we're doing it well. Maybe we're doing it better than the other people are. But at the same time, if we recognize the unity of the people of God and not only the diversity therein, but we recognize that, hey, that church down the street, they're preaching the same gospel we are. Maybe we have some differences about the way we're going about it. Maybe some of those differences are important. But if I go sheep stealing, as it were, to use the term that it, gets thrown around sometimes when discussing this in seminary circles, stealing sheep is a jerk move. Yeah.
Sheep stealing?
Yeah. If all of your – and it's critical. It's very much a critical term describing the reality of if you plant a church but all of your growth comes from taking people from other churches, you're doing something wrong. You're just stealing other people's sheep. And there's a problem with that. So the last point I would make before we turn directly to the issue of personality and therefore broaden out is there is a technological component to this in that up until not that long ago, you couldn't do this. You could make a bigger building and maybe you could amplify it. Not that long ago, a century ago and a bit more, you couldn't even do that unless you had a Whitfield or a Spurgeon whose voice could project to 10,000 people. And so there are challenges facing us and decisions that face us, as is the case in many areas that we've talked about on this show, that we haven't faced exactly this kind of thing before. And sometimes it's easy for us to jump forward and say, well, this is cool, let's do this. Or in these cases, this will let us reach more people, let's do this. And while I'm sympathetic to that, I think there's a sense in which we need to be willing to stop and say, what does that lose us? Because with any technological advent, there are always gains, but there are also always losses. And sometimes in some contexts, we can say, oh, this is a gain over here, but over there, we shouldn't do it. Maybe we want to say all of our conferences, we're going to broadcast live to the whole world, but our services, we're not going to do that. You know, being willing to make those kinds of delineations for the sake of things like community and for the sake of avoiding hubris and avoiding self-aggrandizement, I think is something we really need to seriously consider as we come at these questions.
Yeah. And Chris and I could talk about this all day.
We could.
But we're going to turn ourselves, to the cult of personality. And that was really what brought this whole issue to a head, is that without Mark Driscoll, there was no Mars Hill Church. And they affirmed this very clearly by literally shutting down the church once he was gone.
Yeah.
And I don't know what this means for the flagship flock of Mars Hill, but in large part, Mars Hill equaled Mark Driscoll in the same way that for a long time, Apple equaled Steve Jobs, Amazon equals Jeff Bezos. Like, these are cult of personality figures who cut a wide swath through culture. Mm-hmm. You just have to say their names, and then you know what type of thing is being referenced, even if you're not talking about them directly. Like, if I tell you it's a Mark Driscoll-y type of thing, like, you know exactly what I mean. And so there's an element, like Chris was just saying, that this is a technological thing. Because 100 years ago, if Mark Driscoll's up in Seattle doing his thing, and I live over in North Carolina, it's going to be really tough for me to find out about him, one, but B, have access to his content on a consistent basis to then become part of his cult of personality.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, you weren't going to be podcasting Mark Driscoll 100 years ago.
Nope.
Which, I mean, the flip side of it, of course, is that these issues of cult of personality are not technologically driven. They're just technologically enabled, because
they're definitely, accelerated, let's call them.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I mean, the Metropolitan Tabernacle where Spurgeon preached did not do so well after he died, because it was very much driven by his skill as a preacher. And now we just magnify that and accelerate that. And the danger we see is that anytime you build any institution on a cult of personality, when that person is gone, you're going to run into serious problems. The institution may collapse. The institution will certainly go through a major period of crisis.
Mm-hmm. And that's, common of civilizations time immemorial, right? You can go back
to Alexander the Great.
Yeah, you can go back to all the classics, prehistory, these are not new issues. But what is interesting is that the cult of personality can get bigger than ever without having to be tied to a military force. Hey, Alexander.
Yeah.
But
Mark Driscoll did not have an army.
At least not a literal one.
Right.
But that issue of the technology accelerating brings people who wouldn't generally be in the situation to be able to be in a cult of personality brought into that. So it's entirely possible for me, who grew up in Oklahoma and was living in Alabama, to know at a pretty, generic level, but somewhat realistic level, that Mark Driscoll was cool and I was a fan of what he was doing for a while there, at least. And so there's definitely a technological element and an ethical element that kind of intertwine, is that, like you said, just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. But also, just because this person is the best at something doesn't mean that they're the only valuable one at it.
Right.
Because it's so easy to say, well, this pastor doesn't preach as well as that pastor, and so I'm going to go to that church. Well, that pastor that church with a great pastor who preaches well may have severe structural issues because he may not be a very good leader of people.
Right.
And maybe you trade off a little bit of, finesse in sermonizing for a much higher level of, being
loving
a good
people.
Godly leader. Yeah. Loving people, being their actual pastoral care person.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough because, he's not as good at sermonizing as this other guy, but should that be the only reason? And I think that goes back to, what we want to get out of church, which is why we started at community and why we're going to end at community.
Right. And I think in terms of applying that to a broader context, maybe it's time that we start asking those questions about our businesses and about other things too, instead of just assuming that the magnetic personality and the visioneer is the person who should always be leading. Are there other qualities we ought to value? And I think in the church, the answer is unquestionably yes. It is interesting that the ability to teach is only one of a very long list of qualifications for being a pastor of a church that are given in 1 Timothy or Titus or these places like that. And I think as Christians who are participating, I mean, I'm not a pastor, Stephen's not a pastor, but we need to be working within the context of our churches to teach others that this is how we should think and these are the expectations we have.
Right.
And then we need to be discerning and thoughtful when it comes to choosing our leaders and choosing whom we will follow and choosing where we will attend. Do we choose just based on the preaching skill? Do we choose just based on the style of music? Or are we looking at those other things that are deeper and in many ways more important?
Yeah. And on the secular side, when we look at these giant corporations like Apple and like Amazon and these, I mean, even Tom's, like these companies that have these big cult of personality things, even though they might be the most exciting and interesting, are they really doing the best thing?
Right.
Now, in the case of Apple, you could sometimes say, well, yeah, they genuinely are doing the best thing. In the case of Amazon, you can almost certainly say, no, they're not doing the best thing. They're really not. They're just the biggest one in the sandbox. And so there's reasons that you would say, I'm going to go do this other thing over here, not because that thing isn't a great thing or because it is, but because I feel like there are other valuable things going on that may have a little bit less, you know, sexiness, but they work better or they're more sustainable or they're not doing unethical practices of beating authors over the head with their publishers.
Right.
You know, so there's reasons to look at our cult of personality and say maybe people with not such a great personality, maybe they're valuable, maybe they're more valuable in some ways than these people who are big and shiny and amazing.
Yep. This has been episode 1.16 of Winning Slowly. All of our content, as always, is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License. So do as you like with it. Just say you got it from us.
The content at the beginning, that song, Lighthouse by The Burgeoning, that is not our content. Don't use it without asking them very nicely.
You can, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes or in your favorite podcast app, and you can follow us on Twitter, app.net, Elo, or Facebook. Until next time, I have been Chris Kreicho.
And I am and will be Stephen Carradini. Thanks for listening.
The main problem we had was we were like, crap, we have too much to say!
It's a software that edits softwares. Now, if it was a software that edited software editing softwares...